So I'm Josephine Ensign. I'm here this morning with Reverend Rick Reynolds, and it is March 6, 2017, a Monday, and we're at Jack Straw Studios. And Rick, as you and I were talking a little bit, this is oral history is for the Skid Road Project, which is really trying to increase an understanding of the complexity of charity health care, safety net health care in King County. So the first question I have for you is what led you to the work that you do? And wow. As part of that, maybe say, like, what your work is.
Yeah, it goes way back. My parents thought it would be good to expose their children to Skid Road activities. And so one Thanksgiving, my mother announced that we were going to come down to help serve a Thanksgiving meal. And we went to the Millionaire Club. Which served, I think, about 400 or 500 meals. And I remember for an hour I just stood and handed out silverware to guys going by. And I found it a very intriguing thing. You know, I grew up in suburban Edmonds, north of Seattle, and I was struck by the life differences between my life of privilege and the people that I was encountering there. I think that kind of just planted a seed in my heart, you know. And I heard about Operation Nightwatch when I was about 23 or 24 years old, and it was at that time mostly focused on clergy going out on the street at night. So I wasn't one of those. So you know, I just kind of filed that away. But when I got asked to go to seminary by the church that I was attending, and that they hired me to be a part-time associate minister, and the first quarter of grad school, I went out and bought a clerical collar and started volunteering out on the street.
Right, so that was here.
That was in
that
Seattle.
Was here.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that was in the early 80s.
So that's how you, and how old were you when do you remember about how old you were when your mother, when your parents?
Oh, yeah. I was like, 13, something
okay.
like that.
So, yeah.
Young
early,
teen.
Early teen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you've worked with Operation Nightwatch since then?
Yes. I'm just about finishing my 23rd year full-time executive director. So I volunteered while I was at the church. I volunteered for 10 years, and then they hired me to be the executive director in 1994.
Okay. So what have been some of the greatest joys for you in this work?
You know, sometimes I have to step back and look because the aggravations sort of pile up. But I feel very satisfied when we see one of our clients get into housing. We see some pretty dire circumstances sometimes, and we're able to immediately respond and get somebody out of a fix. We provide food and shelter every night for 140 people. We also have a small apartment building for formerly homeless seniors, and then continue with the street outreach. But we also have these little things that we do, like providing people with ID so they can get back to work. And a certain percentage of our clients have homes in other communities, and if we can reunite them with a family member or connect them with a job opportunity in another city where they're not going to be homeless, we do that. And I think those moments are really, really fun. You know, you meet somebody in a homeless camp and then find out that they've got a job waiting for them out of town and a living opportunity. And it costs us like $200 to get them there. It's a pretty amazing feeling to get them on their way. So that kind of stuff keeps you going.
And so what about some of the frustrations that you were talking about that pile up?
Oh, you know, so our current crisis, Nightwatch started providing shelter sort of indirectly. We were a conduit for city money to provide shelter. So the city would pay us, and then we would pay a provider for opening up winter shelters when the weather was cold.
Like and winter cots or something? Or?
Yeah, it was just like there was a day program called the First Avenue Service Center that we had a working relationship with, and they didn't use their building overnight. And so I worked out a deal with the director saying, you know, would you pay your workers and then just pass the costs on to us? And so for 20 years now, we've been doing shelter kind of by contracting with other organizations that are experienced shelter providers. And so we got away with sort of using other people's space all those years and just paying the workers. Well, that ended about 3 years ago, and we had to go out and rent space. So we rented space at the Pearl Warren Building, which is on 12th Avenue near Beacon Hill. And we've had 75 guys of the 140 that we serve every night, 75 of them go to the Pearl Warren Building. And that happened to be the building that the mayor selected to be the site of his new pet project, the Navigation Center. Mm-hmm. And so we've gotten a 90-day notice that we have to move out of there, taking our 75 guys out to a future we don't know. You know, we don't know what's going to happen to them. We don't know what's going to be the future of our main shelter. So the city's promised to work with us. They gave us a sheaf of commercial properties, all of which are like extraordinarily far from where Night Watch is located. Mm-hmm. We're located at 14th and Main, which is a block off Jackson and Rainier, pretty centrally located. And, you know, the thought of having to ship our guys down to Georgetown to sleep in a warehouse someplace is kind of frustrating. So we haven't figured it out. The city's assured us that there'll be a solution. So this afternoon we're going to go look at the Bertha Landis room. So,
and where's that one?
It's in City Hall. It'll be a temporary fix
until they find something else.
Yeah, because they've got to redo the building that we've been in
before they open up the multi-service center.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, interesting. So Georgetown is one of the potential.
I mean, yeah, they gave us a couple of different options. One's down Rainier Valley. It's $8,000 a month, so I got to figure that part of it out. You know, we've been paying $3,100 for the place that we are now. And of that, the city's been picking up a portion of it. So
displacement of 75 men in
yeah.
the program.
Anytime there's a change to people that are, you know, have fragile emotional and mental states, any minor move can be a real hazard. So I remember we had a move about 20 years ago, and it was only a block from our location. So we had been serving people in one location, and we moved a block away, and we lost clients because of it. They wouldn't go down the hill because they didn't feel good about it. You know, they just it was amazing.
So just that one kind of like a very short move.
Very short move, and we lost people.
And that's, I mean, a very common kind of question people have that don't understand a lot about homelessness is why don't we just get people to outlying areas where rents are more affordable?
Right. Well, they're doing that now, though. It's really interesting with the shelter plus care where they'll move somebody out of a shelter. I had, you know, a client that I knew from a shelter program that ended up in Tacoma. And, you know, he's calling me because it was him and another guy that both were working, and the other guy lost his job. So now he's like scrambling 2 months after getting into this housing, you know, how is he going to pay rent? And I don't know anything about Pierce County. I don't know if he's even eligible for support from King County or not.
Right. So he lost the job because of the move.
Because of the move. No, there was something else going on. It wasn't the guy I knew that lost his job. It was the other guy.
Okay. So it sounds like a lot of the frustrations are the different kind of changes in terms of administration and
there's that. Actions. There's also just, you know, there's a kind of a frustration that can build up with clients that don't make good decisions for themselves. I mean, it's partly we all make mistakes, you know.
So how do you deal with that?
I tend to err on the side of generosity, you know. Yeah.
Meaning what?
Well, I'm somebody that believes in third and fourth chances because I've needed them, you know. So that's kind of where I'm at. So I think that can be a problem for some people. Sometimes, you know, the determining issue is safety for others too. You know, if somebody's out of control and you have to make a hard decision. We've had tenants, senior tenants that whose lives were unmanageable. And they were getting to the point where they were jeopardizing the peace and comfort of other tenants, you know. And it takes me a while to figure out that I've got to get somebody out. So it's a horrible thing, but I not only help the homeless, I make them, you know.
You make them homeless.
Yeah.
In terms of having to evict them if they're not following rules.
And it's pretty minimal. It's like, okay, don't scream and walk in the halls naked at 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff.
Right.
So reasonable expectations.
But they're just having difficulties with mental health and
mental
substance
health
abuse.
And addiction disorders.
Yeah. Right. So. Right. And so how are you feeling about especially the addiction kind of situation in Seattle, King County now?
I've been on the board of a North End community of homeless people, a homeless camp that is getting organized or is organized, I guess. We're semi-organized. It's one of those that follows the model of moving every 3 months mm-hmm. from one church parking lot to another. And, you know, drugs seem to be kind of an ongoing issue for campers. And, you know, on the one hand, yes, marijuana is legal and it's probably not as impactful as other drugs or alcohol can be. But it impacts our ability to get churches lined up to help, you know, provide care.
Because they object to even marijuana use.
Well, yeah, most churches don't want marijuana use going on in their parking lots, you know. And and it's hard to develop the idea of discretion, you know, if you're – and from the homeless point of view – this is their home, right? So it shouldn't be illegal for them, since it's not illegal for you or I to mm-hmm. smoke marijuana in our own home. They feel as though the tent that they're sleeping in is their home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I understand the issues involved, but it makes it more complicated to garner help from the community, so
that's something that you're dealing with.
Yeah, it's something I'm dealing with.
And then, what about like in terms of the kind of heroin epidemic? What do you notice with that?
Yeah, well, I like the idea of having you know, a safe place to inject. I think it keeps people engaged with services. They're offered treatment options. They're kept alive. I'd rather have people in a location where they're safe and the community's safer mm-hmm. too, I think. So, I mean, we can put our heads in the sand about it, but it's really a necessary thing. We don't, you know, obviously don't condone it, but we try to make it as safe as we can at Night Watch.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no clue, you know, like what percentage of our clients are using heroin. I have no idea. We keep, you know, a place for them to drop needles and, you know, I'd rather have them inside than out in the alleyway.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And how do you, like, negotiate that with, like, the faith-based communities in terms of...
We just don't spend a lot of time talking about it in public, yeah. Right. I get asked... You know, once in a while, aren't these guys just all abusing what you offer so that they can maintain their lifestyle? And I think, you know, what we have seen is that when you get people inside and safe, their use goes down. The 1811 building that the ESC mm-hmm. operates is an example of that. And to a lesser degree, the 24 residents in our apartment building. We've seen the similar kinds of outcomes where a guy that's got, you know, maybe an alcohol problem is able to moderate his use, or even we've had instances where they decided that they were ready to quit and successfully maintain sobriety while they're living in our building.
Because they have that safety.
Because they got safety, yeah. You know, and sometimes they'll move in, there'll be a test, like they get drunk on a weekend, see what our response is. We're not going to kick you out. You know, this is a regular apartment building. For one thing, you have to go to court to move somebody out. And you have to be pretty seriously bothering your neighbors to make it happen. But, you know, but we've had more than one guy that moved in and stayed sober once they got in.
And have you noticed something similar with, like, mental health kinds of issues?
Well, yeah, because they're able to get regulated. They're able to access healthcare more easily and keep themselves more organized once they're inside and fully rested and get good nutrition. We provide a meal as a part of the deal. You know, we have volunteers that come in and cook every single night of the year.
Nice.
And then we supplement that through the week here and there. We have you know, various meal programs that they can participate in.
Right.
And good rest, good nutrition, and drinking water, you know.
And safety.
And safety.
Yeah.
And that Maslow's hierarchy of need really kicks in, you know. It's like, yeah, they're willing to work on some higher order needs after those things are met.
Right. So you've really kind of seen firsthand.
We have seen it firsthand, yeah. The housing first model really makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think it takes a lot of convincing of people that aren't, you know, current in the science of it or haven't thought it through much, you know.
Or known somebody that has gone through this or gone through it themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, even some of the recovered people, the people in recovery that I know, sometimes feel as though the housing first model rewards bad behavior. Mm-hmm. But I keep thinking, you know, there's a lot of folks in housing that still struggle with mental health and addiction disorders. But it's a lot easier to deal with when you're inside than when you're sleeping in the jungle or in a sort of tenuous shelter situation. I wonder about the level of rest that happens even when they're in a shelter, you know, especially a mat on the floor kind of emergency night-to-night shelter like Night Watch provides.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a bit of that. You know, I mean, the King County Admin Building, the City Hall already, you know, they shelter something like 175 people between those two sites. Our shelter shelters 75 in one location and 28 in another, and then we top off the rest of the shelter network every night. And it's very tenuous for all those people. And then you think about the more than 4,000 people outside at night. How are they getting any rest at all? You know, crying out loud. I'd be talking to myself and pushing a shopping cart in 3 weeks of that, you know, myself.
Right. So how do you take care of yourself or help other people?
My wife would say not very well. can you hear it? I have intense periods of high stress and over-scheduling, and I try to work in a rest day. I have both my parents are still living and active, you know, 89 and 92 years old.
Nice.
So I'm taking a day off to go with mom to get her eyes worked on this week.
Yeah.
That'll be like a day off.
Right.
You know. I used to run a lot, but the knees won't let me anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Right. And what have you noticed, like colleagues or people you work with in terms of kind of professional burnout?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, everybody's different. We handle stress in different ways. Some people internalize it. I'm an extrovert, so I tend to talk a lot, talk it out, you know. And I have small groups that I'm a part of that have been very helpful. So
kind of support groups.
Yeah, or, yeah, they're recovery groups.
So right, nice.
That's helpful. Yeah, I've had, you know, people that get pulled into somebody's drama too deeply and just have to exit.
Yeah. And do you supervise people with around that, or is it
we talk about it. I don't know that we've been doing a very good job of talking about it. We've been much more conscious of it the last year. We lost a really good worker who just needed to distance themselves from it. And part of it is, you know, it's difficult work emotionally, but it also doesn't pay very well. And in Seattle economic climate, it's tough to keep body and soul together when you're, you know, seriously underpaid.
And then dealing with other people's
and then dealing
issues
with other people's
as well.
Issues, exactly.
Right. So are there is there like any kind of memorable moment, you know, obviously protecting individuals' identities, but anything in particular, like a story that you'd want to share?
Well, it's kind of a life-altering moment I had about my first or second month on the job. A lot of what we do is late at night. Our dispatch center where we do the feeding program and whatnot opens at 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a wide variety of people. We used to just take walk-ins, and a guy, I'll call him Bobby, was a guy that suffered from mental health issues and drug and alcohol issues, and had a hard time controlling his mouth. It just, you know, was going all the time. And so we would, you know, call our shelter to say, hey, can you take him tonight? And they'd, you know, the workers would say, well, no, he's disruptive. And one by one, all the various shelters, so like Union Gospel, the Downtown Emergency Service Center, Bread of Life Mission, the Night Watch shelters, wouldn't take him any longer. So he would come in, we'd feed him. We'd tell him he needs to go work it out with the shelters. We'd have to listen to a certain amount of criticism, let's say. and then give him a blanket. And he'd roll up and go someplace, find a doorway, you know, night after night. And one night, I'm standing in this room packed with homeless guys, and Bobby's looking at me, and he's holding a little ticket in his hand, which tells me he got in. Somebody did
the lottery ticket thing.
Yeah. It's not a lottery. It's just, you know, we called the shelter and they said, go ahead and send him. And all I can figure is maybe there was a new worker at DESC that didn't check the list too close.
Right.
And so he's standing there grinning at me and he says, Pastor Rick, ain't I beautiful? I looked at him. No, that's what I thought. But I decided to be generous. I said, yes, Bobby, you're beautiful. And I rationalized myself later, you know, Christians believe that everybody's made in the image of God. So I realized I was okay. You know? But everybody in the room kind of heard me tell this guy that he was beautiful. And then he goes, okay, then hug me. So I was like, okay, this is a good test. So I got up next and tried to do like a polite.
The man
the
side
The buddy hug,
hug
right? Buddy hug around the shoulder. And he turns into me. He's like 8 inches taller than me. Wraps his arms around me. He's pressing his cheek into my cheek, and the bristles are just poking me, and I holding in the clinch, and the smell of like body odor and cigarette smell and cheap wine, just like a fog descended on us, and kissed me on the cheek, and he went off to his shelter for the night, you know. And at first, you know, I was kind of like patting myself on the back. That was really a beautiful moment, you know, and way to go, Rick. Then I got this little nagging question later. It's like, okay, who is being the ugly one in that situation? You know, I was like more concerned about professional decorum, keeping safe personal space, whatever it was. I just did not want to get up close to this guy and embrace him. I was being standoffish. And somehow I just don't think that's the way I should be as a follower of Jesus. I can't imagine being called to do this kind of work and not embracing people. And so it's been a challenge to myself to really get over myself and be that open, loving, truly affectionate person I think we're all called to be, you know, regardless of your faith system. This is a human being, you know, and I think we're all called to show compassionate care. Safety, yes, but, you know, I just, you know, that, so that first month or maybe the second month on the job, that lesson has stuck with me. And what I've realized since then is if you can't love the guys like Bobby in the world, then it doesn't matter that you get along with your best friends.
Or your wife or your husband.
Yeah, exactly. The people that are easy to take care of, the people that are easy to love. What challenge is that? You know, we're here to learn how to love the Bobbies of the world. That's our life work, you know. And then I realize as I'm telling this story at, you know, Kiwanis clubs and in different settings, wherever I go, that we all can think of a Bobby in our life that's a difficult person to get along with. Everybody's got them, mm-hmm. you know. And it's a good thing that we work at this because sometimes I'm the Bobby. Sometimes I'm not sensitive to the people around me. Sometimes I'm yapping when I shouldn't yap. Sometimes I'm don't smell so great. And I want to think that the people that care about me won't turn away, right?
And they'll still see you as beautiful.
Yeah. Exactly. Sometimes nice. I'm the Bobby.
Yeah.
So that's one story that's stuck with me.
And any idea what happened to the real Bobby?
No. Well, that was the really interesting thing was we got him into shelter that night, and I did not see him at night watch again.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, I know he's still – or he was still around town, you know, because – I've seen him, mm-hmm. but not for a long time. Yeah. Yeah. But it did kind of add an extra air of mystery about the moment, mm-hmm. you know.
Because it could have been some sort of turning point for
him. It could have been. He got inside. Maybe somebody, you know, connected him with a service mm-hmm. or, you know. Sometimes people get moments of clarity and dramatic change happens. That's... You know, one of the stories from our apartment building, we had a fellow that was the night I met him, he was intoxicated in line at night watch, and he said to me that he had washed out of 9 recovery programs. Mm. I got to think of a name for him, John. So I said, well, John, why don't you come tomorrow and see me because we've got a room for you upstairs. And so he showed up the next day, which is, you know, kind of unusual. It's a little higher functioning when people hold an appointment on time,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I mean, I make a lot of appointments that are no shows.
Yeah, especially when he was drunk.
And yeah, exactly. So he told me, he came to my office and he said, Pastor Rick, I've determined that never again in my life will I own a lawnmower, which I thought was a wonderful sort of purpose statement for a life. Mm-hmm. I have since tilled my whole yard, so I have no lawn. Mm-hmm. But his point was that he had everything at one point and lost it, and he didn't need it, you know. So there's some kind of insight going on there, but he's still struggling with his alcohol issue. He's pretty profoundly alcoholic, and I said, well, you know, we got a room, and yeah, he filled out his application. It's just like a 1-page form, and he listed references, and one of the references that he listed was Jim McDermott.
Oh, really?
So then I'm thinking, well, you know, I should go ahead and call Jim McDermott's office. I thought maybe the guy was just, you know, delusional. I called Jim McDermott's office and I said, hey, John's applied for housing with us. They said, oh, John's such a great guy. He really needs help. Will you, you know, take care of him for us, would you?
So they really, you really knew him.
They knew him. So anyway, so John moved in and he was probably the most toxic alcoholic I'd ever seen. That's saying something. You got to understand it. 10 years of street work and 23 years of full-time work. That's a lot of alcoholics. You know, he was the most toxic I'd ever seen.
And toxic meaning what?
Well, a fire department was coming in every week and hauling him out. He'd pass out in the hallway, covered in effluent.
Right, right.
Yeah, wrapped in a towel and totally just unconscious, blackout, just really in bad shape. And I mean, he was there for 3 months in and out of the hospital. His room was – they're small sleeping rooms, okay? They come with a bed, a dresser, and a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Got a shared bathroom and a shared kitchen. And so old school SRO.
Mm-hmm.
And his room was so foul-smelling that walking down the hall past the closed door would bring tears into your eyes. While he was in the hospital during one of his visits, we literally stripped his room of everything, took it all to the dump, the carpet, the drapes, the bed, everything went to the dump. And I remember I had it in the back of my pickup truck and tarped off and tarp started flapping and I had to tie the tarp down. I'm standing along a freeway with the wind blowing and the smell was so horrible that I could hardly stand it.
Wow.
And this is, you know, two months into his stay with us, right? So we didn't turn our backs on him, though. We gave him another room, if you can believe that. And he, while he was in the hospital, they
at Harborview?
No, he was at Swedish.
At Swedish, huh?
Yeah, Swedish First Hill. And he was in, they discovered that he had cracked a vertebrae falling down. And they gave him a choice. We can do surgery or he can be in traction for a month and then we'll send you home with a body cast. So he decided to stay in the hospital. Well, 30 days in the hospital, nobody brought him any wine. We came up and visited him every week. How you doing? Not bad, not bad, you know. And he came back a changed human being. He rediscovered a reason to live. He asked himself in front of me, I don't know why I was doing that to myself. He immediately got a job as a volunteer at the zoo as a docent or whatever they call them. So just, you know, charting tiger cubs, helping visitors find where they wanted to go, gave tours at the West Seattle Lighthouse, set up boating safety classes. He was a Coast Guard vet, and doing lots of social good, and was totally done with alcohol, like that 100%.
So just from the hospital stay.
Well.
And everything.
And our visits.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not very pushy about faith issues. I mean, we ask, hey, do you want us to pray for you? Yes. Okay. So. We did that 2 weeks. The third week we walked in, he said, I started praying myself, you know. So he had some kind of faith background and found a way to give expression to that. And I think, you know, 12-step stuff works. I don't know how. It does, I think.
So he connected with AA?
He didn't connect with AA. He just you know, after all the recovery programs he'd been through, he probably had a good background in
– Exactly, yeah.
You know.
The 12 steps.
The 12 steps.
Yeah.
So anyway, he continued to be sober. He moved out, eventually got a job, went back to work in his 60s.
And back in
– Back into the community, rented a market rate apartment and then moved out of town. So I've lost touch with him, which is – a sad thing for me,
you know.
Yeah. So I've Googled him every which way to try to find him.
Talk to Jim McDermott. He might.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah. He keeps up with some people.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So for a while after he moved out, we'd check in every once in a while and I'd take him out for coffee. But He was still sober.
Right.
So.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
So do you have, like, any kind of hopes or dreams for kind of, like, safety net services in King County?
Well, it seems like the city's, getting on, developing more funding for homeless programs. And like I said, we're not on the receiving end, but we're a niche service. So anything they do can improve life for our guys too. So I wonder though, as development pressure keeps on kind of chewing up affordable housing, even while we're, developing what's affordable, I mean, that's a lot of our guys that move into our senior housing, they're 62 years old and up, and they're living on $700 to $1,200 a month. So there really isn't anything affordable other than subsidized housing. The housing at Night Watch is inexpensive because we raise funds to underwrite the cost of the care there. Mm-hmm. So we have a full-time housing coordinator that does landlord responsibilities, but also provides support and plans activities and outings and meals and whatnot to kind of keep people from isolating and spinning out and extending their ability to live independently. And most of the people that stay with us either move into a real subsidized self-contained unit because they want to be able to cook in their own kitchen and use their own bathroom. Mm. But we've had it where people moved out into an SHA building, for instance, Seattle Housing Authority building, and moved back because they missed the sense of community. Mm. It's small, 24 people, but you get to know your neighbors. And
the meals. And
the meals and all the rest, yeah.
Right.
So what was your question?
So what your hopes are for the future of
I just hope, I don't know that we can build our way out of the problem that we've got. This is the real issue that I question is, for instance, the rezone in the U District. I think I understand it, and I understand the pros and cons of it, but nobody's really keeping track of what affordable housing is being lost when you do an upzone. And then I don't know that they're taking into consideration the pressure on the borders of the upzone financially, because what happens is those properties go up in value even though they're not within the upzone area. They go up in value because speculators will believe that is going to creep, and it will creep. I've been living in the Central District almost my entire adult life, and our neighborhood's been zoned now multifamily L3, and I get like an offer a week, at least one, sometimes two or three, from real estate people wanting to buy our property. And so we watch this happen. They buy a property, they tear down a 100-year-old home and build four boxes, and it's distressing, because you lose, like, I'll lose all my light in my backyard and, won't get to know the neighbors probably because they're not going to be out digging around in their yard.
Right. They could be more kind of passing through.
So, but, how do you stop that? How do you stop financial progress is kind of a problem. So hopeful things. I think we've gotten smarter about how we spend money. I worry about things like the shelter plus care because I believe that they underwrite part of the rent when they move somebody out, and it's a limited time. So that person has to start taking responsibility for earning enough money to be able to stay in that unit when their year or so is up. What's going to happen in a year then? How is this guy that hasn't worked for 6 years going to suddenly make enough to support whatever $1,400 a month or $1,200 a month rent, which is kind of modest these days?
And deal with whatever addiction or mental health issues that they might
have. Sometimes it's not so apparent underlying health problems, you know. Sometimes it's glaringly apparent, but yeah, it takes its toll being outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the stress.
Stress. Homeless people die young.
Yeah.
So.
So is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd want to add?
Let's talk about mental health a little bit.
Yes, let's. It's an important issue.
You know, we kind of we went halfway, you know, with because the new medications, people were supposed to be able to live in the community instead of being institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And so we deinstitutionalized people and didn't really fund the community care that they needed to be able to maintain stability. And I don't think it's still not happening. You know, it's been really like 30 plus years of this trend. And I wonder how, you know, like there's probably a statistic out there about what percentage of homeless people suffer from mental illness. Do you have a number? You're in
yes.
the biz.
It also depends on who's doing the study, right?
Sure.
Because if it's a psychiatrist going looking for it.
Yeah.
And then there's also the whole question of and the reality that homelessness itself causes mental instability for anybody, right? So is it did it happen before homelessness?
Right.
Yeah. But it's a significant percentage of the population.
So somehow we've built a wall between mental health and addiction disorders. But addiction is a health problem. It's not a moral problem. It's not a, a person's not going to be able to cure themselves in most cases. So I hope that people that understand addiction disorder and mental illness can use the best science possible to bring about wholeness and healing and have the tools to be able to do that. Because the consequences are pretty dire, not only for the individual but for the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of feel like the wider community is in the same state as the individuals who suffer. We deal with we have our own denial and our own delusions about the state of this community that sort of echoes the problems of people at the margins, you know. And I don't know how one fuels the other, but it just seems like a mess. You know, to me, and but I believe that that there are answers out there. I'm just not sure from what quarter they're going to come. Like, how can we possibly build enough housing for the 4,500 or whatever that are completely unsheltered at this point? And the city's been focused on not managing homelessness, but ending it. Right,
mm-hmm.
That's been the mantra for 12 or 15 years now. And in our case, see, we're saying, okay, that's fine. You guys go do what you need to do, but we're going to take care of the people that don't even have basic shelter,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's really debilitating to be outside. We see that. We see the mess, at Dearborn and around the freeways. And
mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to get right. They're not going to get stable being outside. You know, they have a better shot at surviving and being engaged, keeping them engaged with services overnight. So, you know, I think I'd like to see some effort to just simply warehouse people until you got the big solution figured out. You know, you're going to build, but let's go ahead and get as many people inside as we can. And I think that will kind of take pressure off in neighborhoods who feel threatened by the mess and by the behaviors
mm-hmm.
that we see now. So
Nice. There's still a lot of work to do.
Oh, geez. It's beyond us, really, in so many ways. Because I don't know, I've seen figures. I don't know how current these are, but something like, you know, at one point I heard the former head of the Committee to End Homelessness, so it's, you know, 5-6 years mm-hmm. ago or longer, say that it costs about $240,000 per unit to build low-income housing. How are you ever going to afford to build your way out of it, you know, if you got 4,500 units you got to get, you know?
Right, and that's assuming it's static when it's
yeah
when
oh yeah it's very dynamic people, right?
Right when it's coming yeah. through
yeah so one of the things that I feel really good about though is like the 120 that we've been able to move off to another community where they have a place to be mm-hmm. you know whether it's family reconciliation or new job opportunities or even treatment. Sometimes we've moved people into a 6-month treatment program across country because we know that that's the first step that they need for getting right. So.
Right. And you keep up with some of them to kind of know a bit,
some of them,
bit of the...
Some of them. This is the hard thing for reporting outcomes is that you're sort of dependent on them mm-hmm. to report back.
Right. Know. And in many cases, people don't want to necessarily... Keep yeah. that connection for whatever
well, yeah.
reason.
Well, yeah. I've been figuring out how to incentivize it, though. It's like, so when we know somebody's moving into housing, is say, let us know. We got a new microwave for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Nice.
So then,
yeah.
then we get a point of contact with
right.
them. And just
good.
Delivered a new microwave, coffee maker, and the television set to a guy who got outplaced. It's like, who needs a bed? You got your coffee maker.
Yeah.
So.
That's important. Well, I want to thank you for taking time today to come in and talk about your work. Thank
Thanks.
You for everything that you do. Appreciate
thank,
it.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Good luck with your project.
Thanks.